Okay, we'll call the council meeting to order at 6:01 p.m. First item will be a moment of silence. We'll stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, and with liberty and justice for all.
Just a little bit of housekeeping. If anyone has any electronic devices, we would appreciate if you would turn them off during the meeting. Roll call, please.
Dennis Olison.
Here.
Bonnie Onion.
Here.
Harry Robinson.
Here.
Steve Lawrenson.
Here.
Mary Lou Stewart.
Here.
Charlie Hawkins and Paul Greeno have both requested to be excused.
I'll entertain a motion for Charlie.
So move.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, the motion is carried 5-0. I'll entertain a motion for Paul Greeno.
Second.
Okay, motion has been made and seconded. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries 5-0. Okay, the next item on the agenda is audience participation. And we have Susan Marks, who is the Whatcom County Commission Against Domestic Violence. Susan, you've been here times before. Welcome back.
Yeah, thank you.
And we look forward to your presentation.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Susan, if you just state your name and address for the record, we would appreciate it.
Sure. Susan Marks, 3015 Pacific Street, Bellingham, Washington, 98226. And I am the director of the Bellingham-Whatcom County Commission Against Domestic Violence. And yes, I think most of you have heard my spiel multiple times, and it starts the same, but there's always a different ending. So just a little bit, I like to do a little reminder of what the commission is and what our purpose is every time I come back. So we were formed in 1998 by a joint resolution between Whatcom County and the city of Bellingham. And in 2006, we went around to all the other municipalities in Whatcom County and had ordinances of support passed so that we could consider our jurisdiction, our service area, every jurisdiction in Whatcom County. And we work closely with lots of different professionals from all of those jurisdictions, so that was important to us. And then our mission is to provide leadership in our community's efforts to prevent and reduce domestic violence. So I think that's a great mission, and it's hard to, for people sometimes, figure out where we fit. So we really have two areas where we have responsibility, and one is over our community response to domestic violence. So we work with all the different people who respond to survivors, perpetrators, and their children. We're not working directly with them, we're working with the people who work with them. So legal professionals, criminal justice system, we also work with schools, child protection, faith communities, any social service providers. There's all sorts of different systems that survivors and their children, perpetrators, come in contact with. So we work with all of them to try to ensure that our response is such that encourages survivors to come forward and get help, help survivors and their children heal, helps abusers change their behavior. And the other area that we have responsibility for that is somewhat connected is our general community awareness about domestic violence. This is something we're actually trying to spend a little more time and energy on starting this year. So we want every community member to know more about domestic violence and how to help someone. So a lot of times the first people to know are the neighbors or the friends or the family. We want more people to be prepared for helping families that are experiencing domestic violence and helping that domestic violence end. And we do this work through, we have 28 commission members in your roster, or in your packets, you have full roster. And all of those commission members are leaders in some realm of the community. And the idea is that they have connections, they have influence, they have resources to help us accomplish change. And then we have three staff members who support the commission in that work. So I want to spend a little time talking about domestic violence, because when I talk about domestic violence, or what domestic violence is, because when I talk about domestic violence, I think the first thing that pops into people's minds, the image, is of the woman, maybe a black eye, maybe a broken arm, maybe some other bruises, says she fell down the stairs or ran into something and tripped. And so we're always thinking of that physical abuse and the thing that could be visible but comes with a story. And there's really so many different kinds of abuse. And you have a flyer in your packets, too, that talks a little bit about the different kinds of abuse. And there's all sorts of ways of breaking it down. And there's one national organization that breaks it down in this way, which I like because I think it separates it out well. But there's all kinds of ways of breaking it down. So domestic violence is really about power and control. It's about one partner wanting coercive control over another partner, someone that you're dating, an intimate relationship with. And there's emotional abuse, which can be things like intentionally embarrassing someone in public, preventing someone from seeing or talking to their family or friends, threatening to commit suicide, keep someone from leaving you, threatening to expose secrets such as sexual orientation or immigration status, threatening to have children taken away. That's a big one, and there's a whole kind of list in your flyer. And then there's sexual abuse, which can be any action that coerces or forces someone to have any sexual behavior that they don't want to have. It can also be controlling someone's own ability to control their own sexual behavior, such as their own ability to have birth control or anything like that. And then stalking it's a lot of behavior that if you were with a willing person and you wanted it, might be considered kind of sweet, but when it's unwanted, it is not sweet. It's dropping by unannounced, sending lots of unwanted text messages, voicemails, coming to your place of work, emails, whatever that looks like, giving unwanted gifts, which again might be nice from someone that you care about when you're trying to not be with someone, and that's considered stalking when it happens over and over again. Having other people investigate your partner's life, having other people check up on them, that's a pretty common thing, especially when there are children involved. And then the physical abuse. And again, the physical is what we think of. It can be the serious, it can be the bruises, it can be the punching, the kicking, or weapons. It can also be things like grabbing someone's face and making them look at you, grabbing someone's arm, not letting them leave the room, or making them go somewhere with you, pushing or pulling someone. Some of the more subtle forms of physical abuse are definitely there. Then financial abuse, and it's often one of the more subtle. These are things that I bet with your children at some point, for those of you who have children, that you have probably done some of those things, such as giving someone an allowance and watching closely what they buy. But when you're in an intimate relationship with a partner and you are supposed to have an equal relationship, then all of these things, especially when they build up over time and there's a pattern, things like forbidding someone to work or limiting their hours, preventing someone from going to work, refusing to give someone money for their basic needs, using money to hold power over someone, maybe then they can't leave the relationship because you're the one with the money, those things, that pattern with an intimate partner leads to abuse. And then technology abuse, and this is just the new catch-all for all these new things that are happening, all these new ways that we can stalk someone and emotionally abuse someone and financially abuse someone, all of these things that happen online or through our cell phones. So when we're talking about domestic violence, these are all the behaviors we're talking about, this pattern of behaviors that often include a sampling from all of these different categories. So some of the work that we're doing right now, this is part where you get to hear something new. Some of the work that we're doing right now, we came up with a new strategic plan for the next several years, and we started implementing it this year. We have four primary goals, and one is to engage the community to prevent domestic violence. One is to promote best practices in our community response. One is to increase our community's capacity to address children and youth impacted by domestic violence. And the other, there's a typo on that one. The other is to explore an expansion to include sexual violence. So right now, we address sexual abuse when it's in an intimate partner relationship. We're considering expanding to when it is not in an intimate partner relationship. But right now, that's something we'll be looking at within the next year. So for each of these top three goals that we're already working on, I want to share with you one initiative that we're doing each year. We have several initiatives for each. We'll just give you an idea through a sampling of some of the things we're working on. So we have for the goal of engaging our community to prevent domestic violence through increasing public consciousness of its impact, local resources, and effective interventions. This is where we really want family, friends, and neighbors to know about domestic violence and how to help someone you know. And so we have put together, we've been working on it for about a year and a half, a toolkit for faith communities. We've done a lot of research and survivor focus groups and interviews with pastors from throughout the county and have put together this toolkit that contains resources that faith communities can use. So one of the unique things about a faith community is often the whole family is there. It's one of the few places where we get to touch the whole family, often the victim, the children who are witnessing it, and the person who is being abusive. And that toolkit contains resources for all three of those. It's got prevention resources, things you can do in with your youth groups, sermons for clergy, things you can do in marriage counseling or classes, pre-marriage preparation classes to help people prepare to identify problems and face problems. So we're piloting this summer, and we have an evaluation that we've developed to go along with it. So we'll be piloting in a few faith communities this summer, evaluating that, and then rolling it out more fully within the next 6 to 12 months. Then our next strategic goal is to promote best practices in our community response, and we're focusing on high-risk and high-lethality domestic violence. This we've been doing for a few years as well, especially as resources have become tighter. We've been looking at the most serious cases of domestic violence. And this program is one that we started in 2014 in Whatcom County, the Lethality Assessment Program, and all of the law enforcement agencies in Whatcom County. So in the city of Blaine, all the officers were trained in May and June of last year, and then the Blaine Police Department began this program in July of 2014. So this is when anytime a law enforcement officer goes to the scene of a domestic violence call for service, they have a protocol they follow, and there's basically three different scenarios that could happen where they would do this lethality assessment screen. And it's pretty simple. It's 11 questions, yes or no. They ask the victim these questions, and if the victim says yes to a certain number of questions, then they screen in as high risk. And then that officer responds to that person as high risk. The other thing that can happen is they could say no or refuse to answer, and the officer could say, you know what, I still am concerned. There's something about this that's just in my gut. I know this is not a safe situation. So either way, either based on the screen or based on officer instinct, they can screen the person as high risk. And then at the scene, they connect the victim by phone to a domestic violence advocate, and that advocate starts doing safety planning, getting that person connected for long-term resources and long-term support. And it's like a brief 10-minute phone call, but that connection has been shown to reduce the risk of serious assault and homicide in the future. And so in 2014, in the 6 months, we only have data for the last 6 months of 2014, the Blaine Police Department conducted 12 of these lethality assessment program screens. There are 12 situations where they felt they were called for. In seven of those, they identified the survivors as high danger, at high risk for, and this is for serious assault. And then in five of those, they were able to connect their survivors immediately on the scene with a domestic violence advocate. And the reason for not being able to, I'm not sure in these specific situations, but sometimes the survivor does not want to talk to an advocate. And sometimes, especially with the smaller police departments, they don't have backup. They may have to immediately transfer someone to jail or respond to another call. And if they'll go back the next day, but then we don't count that as immediately being on scene. So this year, we'll have full data throughout the full year from the police department. And then the third thing is increasing the capacity in our community to address domestic violence that impact children and youth. And this is really about prevention. One of the things we've realized over the years of working with domestic violence is that it can often become a cycle, and even as we help one person get out of it, if people are witnessing it, if people are learning some of those behaviors, then it can continue into the next generation. And so we are planning for September. We have had a grant for several years with the Ferndale School District, and we've been working with some youth there to plan a summit. And they had this idea on their own, actually, the students who said, this is awesome, we're doing all this work here, and we interact with kids from throughout the county. This is our whole community. We want to have a full day conference, summit, and invite students from all throughout Whatcom County to attend. So on September 29th, we're having a full-day summit. It's going to be up at Western Washington University. We're inviting teams from every single middle and high school in Whatcom County. We expect to have up to seven youth plus an advisor from each of those schools. And at the summit, they'll have presentations on healthy relationships, on sexuality consent, how to be a good bystander. If you know something's happening with a friend, what you can do, what are your local resources, what is dating violence, what is sexual assault, what are your resources for that. And then at the end of the day, they're each going to sit down in their teams from their schools with their advisor and create an action plan. So what do you want to change in your school? What education do you want to have? What do you want to do to make a difference in your school and in your community? And then those students can go back and implement that action plan in their community. And we've actually written a grant, which we'll find out about by the end of September, to be able to support several schools in that. And we, with the grant, we collaborate with Ferndale, Blaine, and Mount Baker school districts. So if we get that, then we'd be able to specifically support those three districts to implement those action plans and make those changes. And then also to provide some services in the elementary schools as well, which would be excellent. So those are some of the things that we're working on. So if you know people in middle and high school, especially in the school district, we'd love to have youth who are interested and advisors who are willing to go with them and help them bring their action plans back. So like I said, those are just a few. Those are just a sampling. We have several different initiatives happening, but those are just some idea of some of the things that we're working on, some of the things that are happening in your community. And as you are making decisions and out in your community, I think it's important that you understand some things that are happening related to domestic violence so that you can know all the good things that are happening and all the ways that we're trying to make an impact here. So if anyone has any questions or comments, I'd be open to those, of course.
Any questions for Susan? Susan, you mentioned, I think it was 12 cases that our officers responded to.
Yeah, they responded to more than 12. I don't know the exact number, but in 12 they conducted that screen. So there's a reason to believe that there could be some risk. Yeah.
Is that number comparable to cities of our size? Or?
Yeah, I can actually, I have the...
Are we a little...
Let Let's see. So what? Okay. So for example, in the same year in Ferndale, we have data from the entire year because they had started in January. They had 29 in the entire year, so that's a little more than twice as many. But they're also a bigger community. Linden had 22, and they were most of the year. So yeah, I would say you're pretty much on board. SUMAS had 17, but they were more of the year. Yeah. So I would say you're pretty much right on target with what so we would expect would to see. Yeah.
That's 12 families in our community mm-hmm. in which the officer felt
that they should ask those questions. Yeah, and sometimes it was because of the level of physical assault or that they'd been at the home multiple times. Those are two of the reasons that they would ask that, or if they just felt something's not right here. One of the things we found is that sometimes we set up all these goals and then the behavior isn't obvious, but someone who's been working with it a long time would say the behavior's not obvious, but I can tell what's happening here. So we give them that option too. And this is a national program that we're participating in. So yeah.
And you said the rollout for the faith community would be?
We're piloting in, at the end of the summer, we're gonna start piloting in a couple of different faith communities to try it out, so yeah. So hopefully by the end of the year, we'll have some data on what we need to change and improve and what's working, and then.
Will Blaine be included?
We'd love to. Yeah, when we do, we have a couple different ones identified for our pilot, but we hope to. I've actually connected with one pastor from Blaine about our long-term rollout. We'd love to have some pastors from various communities. There's just different needs and different.
That would seem like a very logical way of approaching the problem.
We're natural allies. Yeah.
Any other questions? Susan, we certainly appreciate you bringing us up to date on the work that you're doing. And
we appreciate
you being here, and thank you very much for spending the time with us.
Thank you. Thanks for giving me your time.
Now, we have two other individuals who would like to address the council this evening, the first being Trevor Hoskins. Trevor, would you come as soon as Susan gets chance to get away from the podium, would you come forward, please?
Mr. Mayor, I used to speak on the public hearing of the transportation. Do you want to speak now or then?
Well, you have the option.
I'll speak then, please, sir.
Okay. And the next is Gail Evans. Gail, you would have wanted to speak on the library committee, is that correct? Would you come forward, please, to the podium, and please state your name and address for our record, please?
My name is Gail Evans. I live at 353 Clark Street. I am working with the Blaine Library Board, Friends of the Library. And I'm here tonight just to speak very briefly on the subject of the library's desire to explore the possibility of expansion or constructing a new library. It was about 6 weeks ago that library manager Debbie Farmer came and made a presentation about the services of the library and the need for enlargement of the library. And she also asked the City Council if they would create a committee to explore the feasibility and various aspects of library expansion, and the Council at that time agreed to do that. So I'm here tonight representing the Friends of the Blaine Library to ask how you are doing in creating that board or that committee. In about a week and a half, the Friends of the Library meets, and they wanted to have some sense of where the City Council was in creating that committee and when we might see it actually formed and off the ground.
City manager responded to that.
Well, it's interesting. We actually have several things happening. Michael and I spoke this morning about a report that his Parks and Cemetery Committee are going to be receiving soon as a result of, recall last fall, winter, we had a request for open space acquisition. So this conversation about the library came up earlier today to talk about how it would fit into this whole structure of funding, because there's lots of elements and pieces to it. So I guess the question to the Council would be whether you want to try to wrap it into kind of an existing process or have a separate group set up to approach it. I think the next steps for that report is to go to the Parks and Cemetery Board So if you want them to work on it, Michael, is that within their purviews, do you think, to look at the library facility?
For the Park and Cemetery Board, it's not as defined by the municipal code. Certainly council could authorize them to do that, but it would be a new type of task for them.
So that's the problem, in the sense is that the cemetery is owned by the city as a facility, but it's operated by the district, library district. So there's really not a mechanism, structure, that kind of a structure in place. So either you're going to develop a new structure with a new set of citizens and so forth, or just decide to use the cemetery, Parks and Cemetery Board for that. So you really have two options, I think.
I think it should be separate.
Okay.
Yeah, that was my thought. I don't know how things were organized with the city, but the needs of the library seem to me to be totally separate and very different than the Parks Board. The unique set of circumstances. We are now, the Friends of the Library are now reaching out to other libraries in Whatcom County that have just recently expanded or built new libraries and learning as much as we possibly can about what they went through in the process of expanding their library. And it's a very unique set. I mean, every library is very different. And it just strikes me that for Blaine, what the library does and what the cemetery and the Parks Board does are not necessarily overlapping that much. So I would really hope that there's a committee formed to look specifically at the issues related to library expansion. My hope.
The library, too, the district, and I don't have this factually, I think it's intuitive, but the boundary of the zip code is kind of the boundary of the library user group. So there's a lot of users from Birch Bay Village area, from Birch Bay condominiums and that location. There's probably about 9,000 residents in that area. We've got our own citizens within our own boundary here, which is about 4,700. So I think, you know, I would probably think that from Blaine South to Slater, but I'm not sure what road that would be. Blaine Birch Day Highway, maybe, then it goes east to I-5, or so you can see the geography of it is much larger than Blaine. So if you were going to ask me to put together a committee, I'd probably go right to the library, Friends of the Library, because I'm sure that's a very dispersed group of people who live in that region, and probably ask them to serve in that committee, because I don't think we have any other kind of way to get hold of that geography. Because it's not just a Blaine question, I don't think, unless the city wants to take it on.
I would agree that it's not just a Blaine question as far as users, but it is just a Blaine thing as far as paying for it. It's only going to be Blaine taxpayers that will be paying for it. So, you know, it's a prime concern to the taxpayers of Blaine, how it's done, how much it costs. But certainly it serves the greater Blaine and Birch Bay communities. So. Yeah. I think there's probably some people, are there people on the Friends of the Library that are from Birch Bay? I think that's fine to include them on the committee. Absolutely.
Dennis, you want to make a comment? The boundary of the school district is probably about what covers the library.
That's what I was thinking. Mm-hmm. More or less.
And probably the parks. The question always confuses me, I guess, or the situation confuses me. Why would we build a public library for 9,000 people that do not live in our city?
Because you want them to come here and shop.
Do they have to shop when they come here?
It's an economic engine if it's downtown where more...
No, but I guess, David, what I'm saying is, the county must realize we're going to provide a facility that a far greater number of their people are going to use than we're going to use. And isn't there some kind of an agreement for the county and the cities to work together on those kind of facilities?
No. not to my knowledge. And it's not the county, it's the three entities, right? It's the county
library system.
Whatcom County, and then there's the library system district of the county, and then there's the city of Whatcom. So there's three entities.
The Whatcom library system, as I understand it, takes care of the inside. And the library structure itself is, for the city of Blaine, would be Blaine's problem. And how you pay for it is, you know, I think you'd want to get as broad a support as you can for the people that use it.
Well, I was going to say, perhaps one of the recommendations of the committee is that they build it in Birch Bay.
That's
the majority of the citizens.
That's a possibility.
Yeah. So I would be all in favor of us forming a committee. I don't know, since we would be paying for the facility, whether we want to limit that to people who live in the city of Blaine and or are going to pay for it, or whether we would want to broaden it out to include people who do not live in the city and who would not be paying.
Well, the city of Blaine is very unusual in its footprint. There's a lot of our city that's on Simiamu on Birch Point area. So it's.
But I'm just saying, I think these are questions that the committee itself would want to wrestle with. Where do they come up with the money from? Where do we come up with the money? Because we would be building a library for 15,000 people. And that's a big number to fall on the city of Blaine. Where are we going to come up with the money to pay for that? And so, you know, maybe the county would be a lot better equipped to build a library in the county than we would be to build a library here in the city. And so, but I think those are the things that a committee needs to address. And I would certainly recommend that we start find a form, how would we structure a committee?
To look we can at start this. With the footprints of the library and see where that goes. I think we should talk to Jack Klaus or
yeah.
You know, there's other people at the, in Birch Bay, you know, Jeff Carrington serves as the chair of the Parks District number 2. There's people we have contacts and relationships with now that start asking the question about. We can start on that. It's all coming together, right? We're talking about lots of facilities needs and financial needs over the next year. So this is a good question to add to that conversation.
Okay.
Well, why don't you give your name and address? Would you give to Sherry already?
It's on the record.
Okay, I'll give you a call.
Gail, do we have your phone number? Why don't you come out and state your phone number for the record so it's on?
No, you just give it to him.
Write it down.
Okay.
Thank you for your time. I just want to add that the Friends of the Library are eagerly exploring possibilities for fundraising. We don't expect that the city is going to pay for everything. We're looking at what other libraries have done to raise funds, and we're already thinking and talking about fundraising efforts. So it isn't that we expect the city or the county or any just single government entity to support this effort. So just to have a committee to explore these questions of jurisdiction, because we do need to be a partner with Blaine or the county, or that needs to be decided.
Sure.
Okay. Question? Can I just ask you, do you have any idea how much bigger your space you need?
Well, I know that when Debbie Farmer gave her presentation about 6 weeks ago, based, I think, on 2010 estimate of the speed of that new space, 15,000 square feet. Now the library is about 5,000 square feet.
Okay, so triple.
Triple in size.
And that was an estimate of 5 years ago. And if you've been in the library, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, very inadequate.
Every inch of it is heavily used. So I don't know if that's the end square footage that is adequate.
Thank you, Gil.
Thank you for hearing. Thank you.
Mr. Mayor, may I add something briefly related to facilities?
Yes, you certainly may, Mr. Gil.
I just feel like this is an doesn't seem to be as loud as usual. I think this is an opportune moment just to remind council and to mention that we are in the process of updating our comprehensive plan, of course, as you know, and one of the components of that is the public facilities element. So there's a chapter that looks at things like what will the needs for a city hall be in 2036, and what will the needs for the police department be in 2036, for the public works service yard and public works administrative staffing, and also for things like the library and the senior center. So we're doing that now through the Planning Commission on sort of a preliminary level. It won't go into tremendous detail related to all the needs of all of those departments 20 years from now, but you will get some of that preliminary information. We've just conducted a series of interviews with all the different associated parties, including Debbie at the library, and then we'll be presenting that to the Planning Commission. I'm thinking we're probably going to do that as a joint study session with Council and the Planning Commission, because there's a lot of information there that the commission will need to digest and send forward to you. So while that's not the venue to necessarily flesh out all of those details, I just did want to make sure that you were aware that that's also happening, and in fact happening right now. We met with Debbie about a week ago to talk about just that item.
Now, those changes will come up in effect of January 1?
Those would be when our comprehensive plan is adopted, which will probably be June 30th of 2016, thereabouts, so about a year from now. Those are not things necessarily that will de facto say all these things will happen by 2036, but it essentially establishes for the city a guidance and a guideline for us to achieve. In other words, if we say we want to have a similar level of service for, say, court staff as we have today in 2036. Well, when there's a population of 4,400 more people, that probably means either they need to get a whole lot more efficient, or this room needs to be bigger to have a bigger court, and maybe there needs to be another person hired or whatever. I don't know how that pans out. But it's that kind of information that you will get in a pretty global sense get to you in about 6 weeks, a couple months maybe. I think that will also help flesh out what a much more detailed effort would be being done by a committee.
Would the issue of jurisdictional responsibility be raised at that level?
To some degree, but ultimately this is going to be a council decision on what to adopt into that comprehensive plan. And I know what you're getting at, the same thing you were just talking about related to, we serve as the sort of focal point for a larger community. The school district, for example, includes Point Roberts. That's not the city of Blaine. That's pretty far flung in a lot of ways.
But
the senior center and the Boys and Girls Club and the library, all of those like so-called non-city entities that we're somehow engaged in or responsible for do serve a broader area. And that's a topic the commission's going to have to wrangle with. And I think that we need to do that here in a joint study session, because they need your input to create a document you can read and say, yeah, that's pretty much what we're thinking. Otherwise, they could come up with something completely different than what you're thinking. So I just want to let you know that that's happening there, because you might hear like, oh, well, Debbie already met on that. Well, that's because we're doing this effort.
I appreciate that, Michael. Okay, Sherry, written communications, do we have any?
We received a letter dated May 26 from Joseph Reig regarding the proposed boathouse fire code amendment, and that is being added to the record for the public hearing. We received a notice dated May 28 regarding the Blaine Pavilion groundbreaking that occurred on June 1st. We received an email dated May 30th from Howard Woods regarding traffic on Upper D Street, and today we received an email from John Urich regarding a follow-up on his email dated May 21st.
And the normal type of responses have been made in terms of acknowledgement, at least that we've got their letters.
Do you want to
Mr. Mayor, our intention is to get back Mr. Urich. Unfortunately, just between different schedules, the three of us hadn't had a chance to sit down yet, so I apologize.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. The next item on the agenda is the consent agenda, approval of bills in the amount of $240,489.35, approval of payroll in the amount of $490,668.05, approval of council minutes for May the 26th, 2015. I would be willing to entertain a motion to approve the consent agenda.
So moved.
Okay.
Second.
Motion has been made and seconded. Are there any questions or comments concerning the consent agenda?
I had one.
Okay, Dennis, go ahead.
There was an item in here for architect. And does the city get reimbursed? This is a third party.
What's the name alphabetically? It helps.
It's Christensen.
Christensen. Yes, yeah. The city is reimbursed for that fee. It's a third-party review that the applicant pays for when there's a design review question or conflict.
Yeah, does that answer your question, Dennis? Yes. Are there any other questions or comments? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. Hearing none, the motion carries 5-0. Next item on the agenda is a public hearing. And the first item on the public hearing is, and it's continued, it's Ordinance 15-2863, amending Title 15, establishing new boathouse and covered moorage fire code regulations, and amending certain marina fire code regulations. Michael, you're going to...
Yes, I'd like to just introduce this. Introduce I also have something which I've provided to the clerk that I'd like to just give to you now, which is a copy of a slightly revised ordinance from the one that you saw 2 weeks ago. I don't really have a whole lot to add on this item. We have received a couple of letters. We have had some ongoing communication with the Port of Bellingham. You will recall that we had a public notice process. We sent out letters to the owners of boathouse facilities. And we've been coordinating with the Port on this from the beginning, and of course with the Fire District on this from the beginning. So Mr. Hollander is here from the Fire District to be able to provide you with some additional information on a couple of items and just the Fire District's perspective on things. The reason that this meeting or this hearing was continued for 2 weeks was so that the Port of Bellingham could do some additional research on the code as proposed and also how their system is operating. In other words, like what are some of the pressure levels and things so they could figure out a little bit of how that works. So the amendment that they've requested, which we've worked through with the Fire District and everyone feels, the three parties feel comfortable with, is on the last page, not the very back, but the front of that last page, and it's highlighted in red. And it's just a somewhat of an exception to allow the fire chief some, or it's actually the fire code official, but essentially the fire marshal or chief, some discretion in allowing a slightly less onerous or slightly a smaller fire sprinkler system if for some reason there is a significant burden in being able to put in the greater system. An example of that would be if all the existing infrastructure coming from the public water main out on the street were a 6-inch line, and in order to upgrade to that other fire system, you'd need to put in a 10-inch line, and that would involve ripping up all of the sidewalk and the parking lot and putting in a greater line and putting in new facilities all the way down the pier and onto the float in order to add three more sprinklers or five more sprinklers in the boathouse. We're trying to create an allowance for the fire department to say that
there still needs to be a sprinkler system, and it still needs to be what we believe adequate for this. But given the significant effect that would occur if this were upgraded to a level two, then we will allow a level one. So it's just a little bit of allowance for existing systems that are in place. And that you'll see that's pretty consistent with what was written in here. There were a number of exceptions. So would still require a fire sprinkler system, but it might require a little bit less intense fire sprinkler system with that amendment.
And that only applies to existing structures and not new structures?
Yes, that's true. That only applies to existing structures, not new structures. But if the new structure were connecting to a line that didn't have the capacity to serve it, it might also be eligible for that exception because of the way that it's worded. It doesn't say for existing systems only. A lot of the other exceptions are for existing systems. This one is actually built in that essentially says if you don't have the fire flow, if you don't have a big enough pipe, then you might be able to put in a slightly less intense sprinkler system.
And that has nothing to do with the city. It's our code, but the decision for that would be left to the fire department.
It would be left to the fire official. The city and the fire district could determine that the fire official is a city employee. Could be that the city could have a fire marshal, but to date, it's in the fire department's hands, the fire district's hands. So yeah, they would make that decision. Much more qualified, obviously. We don't have that staff person in the city. So that's the only thing I wanted to bring up, is that we're looking at that little tweak. We expect to bring this back to you as an action item in 2 weeks on your agenda if you close the public hearing tonight. And I know that Mr. Hollander has a couple of comments. Also, Mr. Peterson, the harbor master, is here if you have any specific questions for the port and how they're viewing this and the effect on them and some of their property owners and leases. Do you have any questions for me before I sit down and let Mr. Hollander speak?
Bunny has some has a question.
We had a letter from Mr. Reek.
Yes.
Were his concerns addressed, and does this change address?
To some degree, it may address one of his concerns. I know that Henry is prepared to talk to that letter specifically more so than I, so I'm going to let him answer your question. Yeah. Anything else? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Hollander, would you?
Evening. First of all, fire sprinklers work. We know that they work very well. This ordinance actually goes back about a year and a half ago when Mr. Greeno came to me actually and asked if we could look at our boathouse situation and compare it to what happened at Squalicum Harbor a couple years ago where they had those fatalities. So we did that. And we realized that the older part of the boathouse did not have sprinklers, the phase two, the larger part did. So we began the process of putting together an ordinance and realized that the city hadn't adopted the current fire code. So we went through those steps last year. In the meantime, Bellingham actually wrote an ordinance itself after that, the catastrophe they had, and that was kind of the basis of the ordinance that we took to adopt here. So it's very similar in that effect. I'm not so concerned about the fire flow, and maybe Andy can address that because I haven't had a chance to talk to him on the water flow, but the old boathouse system actually sits in front of the new boathouse. And so the water pipe that supplies the new boathouse runs right through the old boathouse. And so when they add the sprinklers heads to the old boathouse, the volume should still be there, and that kind of goes to Mr. Rigg's letter. He says that all the sprinklers go off at once in a fire, and they don't. Only the sprinklers that get hot enough where the fire is actually flow. And when a sprinkler designer engineers a system, they only calculate somewhere between, depending on the occupancy load, 5 to 15% of the sprinklers going off. So what we're doing is we have a section of boathouse that already has sprinklers, and we have the supply line to it running right through the older boathouse that doesn't have sprinklers. So in my mind, there should be plenty of water to supply the 5 or 10% of those sprinklers in that boathouse. And even in Mr. Rigg's letter, he states that he was a witness of the fire that we had a few years back where the sprinklers actually contained the fire to one boat with some minor damage to the boats on both sides. So the sprinklers do work, and you know, I understand, and Andy can address this, that people don't necessarily live in their boats in the boathouses, but I don't know how we can guarantee that, you know, on July 4th or July 5th or one of those busy nights and with the weather we've been having now, it wouldn't surprise me if people were currently spending the nights in their boat's house. So the boat houses do have an inherent risk because they're enclosed. So you've got a cap on them. So you've got the fiberglass and fuels and all of this contained with one access point here in Blaine to get in. And it's a bit of a delayed response, not getting there, but getting hooked up to it and getting out to the dock with your hoses and your sprinklers. So the couple fires that I've been involved in there, the sprinklers worked, and they actually contained the fires to the boat that was burning. So basically what this ordinance does, it's going to allow Boathouse 1, or it's going to require Boathouse 1. They have options, but the most economical one is to install sprinklers, and they would have a five-year window of opportunity to complete that once we do the inspection after the ordinance is passed. So if you pass the ordinance, we'll do the inspection within the next month. We'll write a violation notice, and then the clock will start, and they'll have 5 years to provide the sprinkler system.
Dennis has a question for you. In Mr. Riggs' letter, just to be clear, he's saying that those sprinklers, because they all go off at once, would be a problem. But you're saying that, no, they don't go all off.
That's correct. They do not go all off at the same time.
So we need to get him that information so that
we could do that.
Yeah.
And then he also states that he only had 2 points, the economy. It's not a good time in the economy. The codes aren't written with the economy in mind, and hopefully it'll be better in the next.
But as you said, we'll have 5 years.
You'll have 5 years.
Yeah. And could this be done over a period of time, various pieces of it?
Well, we're only talking ten slips, so. Economical wise, I think it would be wise just to bring a contractor in and just have it done. You could, start a funding source for it. You have 5 years to collect.
You could pay him over 5 years.
You could pay him over 5 years.
If he was willing to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's right overhead running through it. So I can't imagine that it's going to require a different line. But I'm not a sprinkler engineer.
Buddy?
I think his main issue was he thought they all went off simultaneously.
Correct.
So if we get that information to him, that as far as his particular...
And there are systems, they're called deluge systems, that do that. They're triggered by a different mechanism, mm-hmm. like a pull station, and then when that pull station goes, a big water valve opens and all the sprinklers go off at once. There are systems like that,
but this
not this one. This one actually has a sprinkler head with a fusible link. So each sprinkler goes off as it gets to 160 degrees, each sprinkler pops.
This letter was addressed to the city council, so can we rely on you to...
To contact him?
Can you do that?
I can do that for you.
On behalf of the city council?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Hey, Dennis, did you have a follow-up on...
No, I was just going to be a smart aleck.
Okay. That's permitted.
Well, I figured if they all went off, your boats wouldn't burn, but
they'd
all sink.
Are there any other questions for the chief? Chief, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Andy, would you like to?
Thank you.
Andy, just for the record, would you state your full name? And we've got to get this electronically recorded, so if you could just state your name and address for the record.
Sure. Andrew Peterson, 4934 Morgan Drive, Birch Bay.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for Andy? Thank you very much, Andy.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Trevor, would you like to come forward at this time? I think you want to speak on this issue.
I'm going to
limit
Honor.
Your comments to 3 minutes, and
Mr. Mayor,
but we'll extend that.
Would you like to be here to talk about the
Okay.
That's what I'm here to talk about.
We'll catch you later. You don't want to talk about this issue?
No, sir.
Okay, we'll catch you later. Catch you on the next item.
Your Honor, did you want to open the public hearing for testimony?
Yes. I thought Trevor was going to do that, but he doesn't talk on this topic. Okay, is there anyone else in the audience that would care to speak to this ordinance 15-2863? This is your opportunity to do so. Okay. 1, 2, 3. Okay. Since no one has come forward, I will take the opportunity to close the public hearing. Okay, the next item for a public hearing is the 6-year transportation improvement program for 2016 to 2021. And Raven, I believe you would like to introduce that.
Knowing that you have folks in the audience who would like to speak on this topic, I don't have anything prepared, but if there is interest by those folks for me to summarize some of what we talked about at the study session, I'm available to do that.
Okay. Thank you. Now, is there anyone that would care to speak to the 6-year transportation program 2016 to 2021? Trevor, would you like to come forward? Well, you're getting used to it anyway. You're getting good at it. Okay.
My name is Trevor Hoskins, and I live at 8686 Great Ornall Lane in Blaine. Mr. Mayor, council members, if this is not the correct meeting to raise this, I'm sure that you'll tell me. But I do not see the path on Semiahmoo Parkway, the Millennium Trail, included in the notice of public hearing on the transportation program. Semiahmoo Spit pedestrian path is included for safety reasons, and I think the same is true in perhaps a different manner for the Millennium Trail, which is a city path. I have previously raised the condition of this path with both the Public Works Director and the City Manager, and they both advised me that we do not have a budget to repair this path. So how do we get a budget? The tree roots have grown through the path in several major spots, and some residents are now walking or running in the roadway because of fear of tripping or falling on the path. I think walking and running on the road is dangerous. None of us are getting any younger, and I think something really needs to be done about this path very soon. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Trevor. Raven, would you like to respond to Trevor's comments?
I'd be happy to, sir. Might this be an opportunity before I get up to see if anyone else wanted to speak, whoever?
Sure. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to speak to the 6-year transportation improvement program? Okay, Raven.
The Semiahmoo path does create kind of an interesting dilemma, but as Mr. Hoskins alluded, the transportation improvement plan really would not be the best place to really address that, with the exception of the fact that, as we indicated in the study session in our last meeting, one of the things that we are doing, and I feel like I should stand sideways, Trevor, one of the things that we're recommending in the transportation improvement plan is that we do a inventory of our sidewalks to identify the worst hazards in the city, and actually using some of the identified sidewalk replacement, annual sidewalk replacement budget to do that. Because without doing that, it's really just based on a worker saw this or someone called in that, and it's very haphazard and not necessarily very efficient. When I spoke to our operations foreman regarding the Semiahmoo path, and we do have a customer service request to look at it, based on not just Mr. Hoskins' input, but actually previous requests by, I believe, SRA through Paul Atchison, we need to look at that path as if it is another sidewalk in the city. We have many sidewalks in the city. We have a lot of trip hazards around the city. And the Semyamu path, while it is unique in that it is paved, it's in a wooded environment, it's off street, you know, it has some other challenges, less visible for a public work person to see as they're driving down the road, so on and so forth. But it still is a pedestrian facility in the city and needs to be addressed with the rest of the pedestrian facilities. That being said, its location is particularly difficult. Simply pick up and put down asphalt again is going to result in nothing but the same problems because of the treed nature of its location. What I've asked our operations foreman to look at is some alternatives to paving it again. We have in other areas of the city where it's a concrete sidewalk, we've grinded both sides of an issue to make it smooth instead of pulling the whole panel out. That buys a little time. There's also more flexible pavements. We call them cold mix, but essentially it's a more granular type of asphalt that can be applied by a crew. It tends not to be as rigid as your typical hot mix asphalt. And quite frankly, in other areas, and this is something that we'll work with the board on if it's decided, is strictly to remove the asphalt and put crushed, nice crushed gravel down. Limestone, similar to what the city of Bellingham has in almost every path in Bellingham. Because it is really fine, it's wheelchair accessible, and it is much, much easier to handle when you have these really serious root intrusion problems. So this is something that, as you can tell by the amount of options I have here, it's not an instant process. But it is one we're aware on and one that we're working on, and we would be very happy to continue communications with Mr. Hoskins as well as the SRA board.
I would just like to comment, too, Trevor. We have a budgeting process, and it's a very laborious one. It starts in September, and we're faced with lots of options. We examine them carefully. Try to determine how much money we have available. There will be public hearings in terms of the budgeting process. And citizens are certainly welcome to come forward and try to influence the council on what should be their priorities. And I would encourage you to follow the budgeting process as we go through it. And if you determine that in your own mind that that's a priority, and you have other folks from Semyamu that feel the same way, you might want to take the opportunity to come forward before the council and stress to us the importance of maybe putting some budget dollars towards that project. So I would encourage you to do that. So it's where the money is going to come from, how we want to use it. And I'll let the city manager, if he has any comments on that. No, but it's really a long process for us to go through, and we will try to put the dollars where we think will be most effective.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Thank you, Raymond. But of course, as you both know, the golf club
at Semyamu and Lomas have just repaired their paths, which have similar situations with tree roots growing through the pathway, and they have done this. I don't think that the budget was astronomical, so I really sincerely ask you to look very closely at this problem. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Trevor, we certainly appreciate you being here this evening. We certainly appreciate your comments, and we'll look forward to having a continued dialogue on this subject. Thank you. Yes, you may.
Raven, is it possible, I mean, I don't know how many spots there are that are dangerous with tree roots and all that, but if it's not continuous and if there's just a few, is it possible to cut those out in select places and just patch it to ameliorate
you? Absolutely.
You know, just as a half measure for now to take away the hazard.
Sure.
At the very least.
I could tell you that based on the pictures and the information I got from Mr. Atchison, it's a lot more than a few areas, unfortunately. And yes, you can cut out the asphalt and put it back down, and that may be what they did in the golf course, but asphalt is rigid, and those roots will do it again. So it's not entirely as straightforward. All I would else do is point out that the Transportation Improvement Plan is kind of the first step in the budget process for streets. We always look to the TIP when we come to you with our CIP each year, and we are showing a partially funded program for an annual street and sidewalk preservation, and it is very, very important. So as we're looking into long-term transportation funding, we need to be thinking about how we're going to preserve and maintain what we already have. And in any event, I assure you that we will continue to work with the board and Mr. Hoskins to try to resolve at least the largest areas of concern.
Dennis, go ahead. Raven, would part of that be if there are specific trees that are presenting problems, you have to remove the trees?
Well, yes, Mr. Ellison, I mean, that's certainly one of the things that we have been doing as we have been encountering these issues on Peace Portal in our downtown area. You see that there are a lot of empty tree wells. One of the things that we're kicking off right now, I think we commented on a street tree grant that we actually were able to acquire to actually get an arborist to help us with some of these issues. And if we do see some specific problem trees and it's limited to that, you know, certainly that'll be something that we will discuss with the board and see if they're open to that as a way of handling the issue to actually removing some of these trees.
So. Well, the other thing would be to grow treeless, rootless trees.
Wouldn't that be nice? This is such a universal problem in cities all around the states, to the extent that they have different types of root barrier systems that are available now for sale. We used those on H Street when we did H Street a couple of years ago. They actually have special backfill for different sidewalk sections now. I know Bellingham's done that in a couple of trial locations to see if putting different materials back in will encourage the roots to go down instead of out. But it still is a process of learning and experimentation, because obviously trees don't grow that big overnight.
Steve?
Raven, I just had a quick question. Do you know roughly how many miles of trail do we have out in the Savannah area that we have to maintain?
I do not know the answer to that question, but I will research it and get back to you. Yeah, I'm sure.
I think the possibility of someone getting injured is a concern. And I think we need to probably be thinking about that and how we address that. Because I know there's people running on there and people going out there on bicycles. And it's, you know, the danger issue is only going to increase. And it would apply if we had a street here in downtown.
Absolutely.
You know, so.
We have plenty downtown that maybe not as...
As I say, this is an issue that we really need to... And I know you're working on it, and I think we need to be really concentrating on how we maintain our streets.
I will try to report back as I gain information.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we're through the public hearings. Now on to council action items. The first one is a bid award for the Peace Portal Water Main over Dakota Creek. And that one, I believe, is Raven.
Getting caught up here with all my different hats this evening.
While you're talking, I'm going to go grab a coffee, so I'm not leaving.
Okay, good to hear.
Thank you.
So this project, as you know, has been in the works for a while. We wanted to get our bid out for this work early, even though the work won't actually take place until the county is nearing completion with their project. But one of the reasons we wanted to get it out early was, first of all, to get a good price, which I think we did. As you could see, the bid is considerably less than the engineer's estimate. And the other reason was to try to engage the existing contractor to bid, which he did. And so the low bidder is Stellar J Corporation, coincidentally the same contractor that built our wastewater plant. But they happen to be the contractor that is doing the county's project. So they're doing the bridge rehabilitation. So what is the advantage, besides they were the low bidder, the advantage to having Stellar J is that they will be able to integrate this work in whatever sequencing works best for them, but definitely while the existing closure is in place. And we strongly emphasized that in the bidding documents, that we didn't want to extend the road closure, and even, in fact, the county indicated that we might have trouble even getting permission to extend the road closure. They'd probably make us do the work with one lane open. And so Stellar J was the low bidder. They're a qualified bidder. We've determined them to be responsive, and we recommend that the City Council accept their bid and authorize City Manager to enter into a contract with Stellar J in the amount of $184,020.
Okay, questions for Raven? Staff recommends that the City Council accept the bid and authorize the City Manager to enter into the contract with Stellar J Corporation in the amount of $185,020. Would you care to make a motion?
I so move.
Motion. Question. Yes.
Raven, is there any chance that there's going to be overruns?
Well, you know, there's always a possibility we miss something. That being said, our design consultant is the same consultant that designed the bridge, and that was also, you know, deliberate. You don't want, you know, two different designers at it. I think some of the biggest risk items, or I shouldn't say I think, the biggest risk item was how the water main was going to penetrate the bridge. One of the things that we did in the design process was have the bridge design team include in the Whatcom County plans a sleeve for the water main. So when they're pouring concrete, we don't need to worry about, you know, whether some fitting or what other wasn't taken into account. We have a sleeve. They're going to slide that water main right through the sleeve. So in my mind, that was a huge risk item that we averted. The other risk item involved essentially connecting to the existing water main and the road crossings and so forth. And we did that internally. The Public Works crew ran the water main across the road before the county started the project. And we have the road, the water main capped on both sides. All they need to do is tie into that cap, and we turned the water back on. So our customers are going to be the least convenience. There will be a short closure, but we've taken care of the worst of that particular supply, and it also just makes it just one straight shot. So we feel like we've done what we can. There's always an air of uncertainty, especially these types of projects. I had a pretty bad experience doing a water main and hanging that from the Eldridge Bridge in Bellingham, and I try to use that experience to benefit Blaine in this case to make sure that doesn't happen again.
Those expansion joints are basically for earthquake. Do you have any kind of movement?
Well, this water main is going to be under pressure, and so those expansion joints are actually intended so when the water main is put back under pressure, it doesn't move. And that was what happened in Bellingham, and the thing went. It was determined to be a fault in the pipe because it wasn't supposed to do that, and you know, and all that. It had a very happy ending, but we didn't want to take any risk with that. So they have serious fittings and expansion joints at every single joint in the pipe.
Motion has been made. Is there a seconder?
Second.
Motion has been made and seconded. Are there any further comments or questions? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion is carried 5-0. Next item on our council action items is the Gateway Storm and Wetland Project Recommendation.
Raven's letting me step in because I think she's getting a little worn out. But we're going to sort of tag team this one. Before we click to the next slide, I wanted to just draw your attention to the screen. The blue line, the blue boundary on that, which is a really odd sort of amorphous shape, is approximately the Cane Creek watershed. The watershed is small. It's really a little creek. Most of the area that drains from the east side, outside of the city limits, goes into Dakota Creek by way of one of the other smaller tributaries. And a lot of the water from this area where we're standing now, the area that's on the west side of the freeway, drains directly into the harbor through storm drains. The municipal changes and infrastructure has drawn water to go directly into the harbor. There were probably some little tiny creeks and things back in the day, but potentially that at one point went into the creek. And then south of here, there's a little unnamed creek that goes through down near the Hughes Avenue, roughly, and it drains out into the harbor. So Cane Creek is really not a big entity in a lot of ways, and most of the watershed is in the city limits already. And almost all of the watershed is within the city and the limits and the urban growth area combined. So it is a unique sort of situation where we can actually have a pretty substantial effect on that water body. And that water body is important because it discharges into Semiahmoo Bay right near the entrance into Drayton Harbor. And Drayton Harbor is an affected water body that doesn't have the highest water quality. We'd like it to be better. And so it's a unique situation where we actually have jurisdiction over most of it, or at least in time we'll have jurisdiction over all of it. So we talk about the creek a lot. I wanted to take a moment to say, so that's the area that drains into that little creek. And that little creek is just behind where you're sitting. And most of us pay no attention to it most of the time because it's down in a little bit of a ravine. It's roadside ditch in a number of instances for the most part, and it's easy to forget about because it doesn't do things like big storm flooding and things that bring it to the top of our attention. But we wanted to come back and give you a recap on sort of where we were. We have a recommendation from the wetlands perspective after talking more with our consultants and from the feedback here from council and from our meeting with some of the stakeholders. Raven also has a recommendation on the storm pond, and we'll talk a little bit about where we'll go from here, kind of moving forward. So as far as the wetland goes, basically what we've determined is, based upon the value of the land out there and the kinds of offers that have come forward, the sale price of the property to Mercer, we've determined that the cost to fill it with the permitting processes, the actual cost of filling the wetland areas, and the mitigation that would be required to fill wetland area, it's just really not feasible. You would create land that was more expensive than you could get for the land that you created. So you end up spending $20 to create something you can sell for $10, and it just doesn't make sense. So that seems to be the determination on whether or not to fill is just the economics of that factor. There are other things involved, like is there demand for the land? So in the permitting process, it could be difficult to get permits because there's really not a great demand for that property. The Army Corps of Engineers will say, so you want to fill this land here? Why aren't you using that land there? It's tough to demonstrate need. But what we have kind of come to determine is it really could be used effectively as an enhancement site. And there may be some small wetlands out there that could be filled on properties where they're very isolated, basically like wet field, small wetlands that might be able to be mitigated just through enhancement. Or at the very least, this can work to assist with other projects as they look for enhancement sites. So it could be very useful to other property owners. But probably more importantly is if this is preserved as a wetland and it becomes a wetland enhancement area, it can be part of a larger ecosystem. There is that creek there. There is a large wetland right behind the public works yard. There is a wetland system across the just to the south on the Klein property that has a lot of mitigation that will happen in it as a result of some of the fill that they're doing and some of their other property in that construction site. There's already been mitigation to the east of that, and there's been a mitigation further east behind the fire station as well, and there are more wetlands in that direction. So this can be part of something bigger, which could have a benefit to the creek in the long term. So our findings really are that what we should be doing with the wetland is to make it available for enhancement. There's some value in that to the city from a couple of perspectives, encouraging development of other properties and potentially making a little bit of money. And that what we would like to do is work on an inventory of other wetland sites in the Cane Creek watershed that could be useful and available, and basically work with private property owners to make them understand, to help them understand the value of their property as a mitigation site, and to help link them with developers who are interested in finding mitigation sites, because otherwise it's really pretty challenging. I think I've jumped ahead of myself on some of the slides. There we go. What we're suggesting from the wetland perspective is to allow mitigation on the old airport property. What we would like to do is create policies and a cost structure so we can have answers for people when they come to the counter. So we'll go through that process with you. So when someone comes to the city manager and says we'd like to purchase an easement, or when they come through development services and they often ask us at our counter, what would it cost to have an acre of wetland mitigation enhancement area, we will have those answers because you'll have already made those decisions. And also to develop some documents that would help that process. Like, so here's our draft easement. This is what you use to develop an lease this land or get an easement from the city on this property. We don't know exactly. There's a lot of different ways that you can do that. We could retain all rights. They could just pay us for it. We would do the work. They would do the work. They would have an easement over time. They'd have an easement that would expire over in time, and then it would become the city's responsibility. There are a variety of ways that can happen, so we'll figure that out as we move forward. We'd also like to create an inventory and a ranking. It's important to recognize these are almost entirely going to be on non-city-owned sites. So we're talking about working with private property owners to help link private property owners in the watershed who have high-value mitigation sites with the development community who has properties where they have wetlands they'd like to fill. And this way, it would be a city-supported program that should be well received by the regulatory agencies, because it's something coming from the city. It's not just my friend Joe has this property, so we want to mitigate on it. We were targeting this property because the city's report says it's the number one priority, or it's the number three priority property. It's a valuable property to mitigate on as far as ecological benefits. So we're looking to develop that program. Now, that's something that we would be spending money on solely from the perspective of encouraging economic development in the city. We're not going to make dollars on that. This is an investment of city funds to encourage economic development, to help properties fill wetlands on their land, to help developers fill wetlands on their properties so they can move forward with projects. So it's a bit of an assistance to the development community from that perspective. So it's important that you know that. So I think it's entirely justifiable, but you want to understand that that's what we're considering doing. Raven has alternatives for her, so I guess it might make sense for me to stop now for questions, if you have questions related to our mitigation wetland findings and then our recommendation.
Michael, on the if there's private property that could be used for enhancement, that obligates that owner to maintain that.
That obligates someone to maintain it, and what usually happens is that the easement holder becomes responsible, and the property owner is only responsible for maintaining it in its natural enhanced state. So in other words, the property owner loses the right to go in there and mow it, for example, or loses the right to graze cattle there if that was something they were doing before. but it doesn't make the proper, most in most instances, it doesn't make the property owner responsible for taking care of the little baby trees until they become big trees. That's usually the easement holder's responsibility.
Any questions? If not, Michael, have you, have your tag team partner?
So, yep, so we'll let Raven pick up from there.
So as we discussed at the study session, we communicated to the stakeholders really the dynamics of A, the Basin 1B, we're addressing property north of Boblett to just serving the airport property specifically, and some of the challenges and benefits to both, and also kind of summarize our intention, which was, we have the option of building something just for the airport property. We have the option to build something bigger for which we have not yet designed. And really, we can't afford to build either one or take on that debt at this time. So the time is now to kind of make a decision so that we can then plan for the future. So our recommendation to them was really reserving that land for a future pond or future stormwater mitigation. And the reasons are very much like we reported to you. It gives the landowner a choice. In the case of this alternatives comparison, the property owners north of Boblett, you might remember that if they were to send all of their stormwater to the pond, they might need to upsize Ludwig, because it wasn't intended to take on that whole area becoming impervious or developed without having that mitigation. Well, you know, maybe that's not the best thing for them. Or maybe stormwater is a part of their design that they wanted to do some kind of cool water feature. So by saying we're going to attribute all this area to this pond really takes away that individual choice. Reason why we're making this recommendation is that it reduces the debt. We have this funding source that every year we don't build something, the debt payments get higher because that's the way the Public Work Trust Fund works. And so there's a concern of on our part that even if this were done as an LID and we use that funding source by the time it's built, the payments are going to exceed the benefit of that funding source. And then the final reason is just that Ludwig, as I was referring to before, and 543 in counterpart to that, because that also might need to get upsized. Once we know who's going to develop and who's going to develop what and who comes first and who's on first base, there's so many unknowns now. Once those things all get determined, then we have a direction for what we need to do on Ludwig and what we need to do on 543. I think when this project was conceived, which I believe was in 2009, there was a lot of hope that land would sell quickly and that this would just all fall right into place. And unfortunately, that's not the case. So looking at the next steps for both projects, and I'll ask Michael just to remain available. We're already in the first step with all that progress. So we're giving you your update this evening on the stormwater pond side. Our intention is to finalize the permitting documents. I spoke with Dale Byes this afternoon. He wants to make sure that all the reports, the geotechnical and the wetland report, they're all buttoned up, they're tidy, so they could be put on the shelf and easily accessed and be viable in the future. And I talked to him a little bit about the dam safety permit and whether or not it made sense to proceed with that. And I'll just back up real quick. The dam safety permit is needed if we build the larger pond and this area here needs to be built, because that is, from the state perspective, the equivalent of a dam, because of its size. And
That permit requires relatively full design to be completed, so you know the full area of what you're detaining, and it has a lot of different analyses for what areas would be flooded if the dam would break and so on. And then there are also annual fees for that permit. So he's saying, just wait on that. Wait until you know what that size is going to be, and then you can apply that. And then on the wetland side, planning intends to create those policy documents that Michael discussed. And then in both cases, we want to do a follow-up. Our stakeholder meeting, while we didn't receive any other public comment via email or mail, or phone for that matter, it represented very few of the full ownership of that area. So we want to do a follow-up letter to them explaining the process and our recommendations and the council decision accordingly. And then as development starts to percolate in the area, Public Works and Planning will provide as much design and construction support as possible, as we want to encourage development of those properties. So with that, in your packet, I kind of broke our recommendation into three parts. And for us to proceed as accordingly, we thought that a council action would be necessary, because it does involve canceling a design contract on my part, and it probably has some other ramifications for Michael as well.
Probably entering into a contract with a wetland specialist. In fact, I'm having a meeting with them tomorrow morning to discuss the scope of work for the next steps.
Question, Raven? Does the area north of 8th Street, is that included in this Cane Creek watershed?
Area north of 8th Street, is that in the Cane Creek watershed?
In some portions.
There's portions,
yes.
Yeah.
And those landowners were notified?
The ones within the watershed were contacted and notified, but not necessarily related to the stormwater very much, because they were never included in the stormwater basin. They were included in our surveys. Mm-hmm. When we were doing the initial wetland outreach, they were included in the notice for the stakeholders meeting that we recently had as well.
Okay.
Yeah, all the stormwater on 8th Street has been addressed via our projects. So the northern boundary of the stormwater pond was 8th Street. We didn't go any further out than that. I will say, just a caveat, the Boblet Court and Mercer were both built with a interim plan for stormwater treatment, and that is largely Skalman Pond. So if we don't build this pond and we fill Skalman, we'll need to do some mitigation for both those projects. But right now, Skalman Pond is serving as the stormwater treatment for both of those.
Okay, the recommendations are, one, accept the staff recommendation to hold land for the purposes of future stormwater and wetland mitigation while refraining from further design work, and two, direct staff to create inventory and ranking of other wetland sites in the watershed using existing budgeted funds, and three, direct staff to create policies to lease land for future wetland and stormwater mitigation, as well as pursue public outreach about wetland mitigation assistance. So that's the recommendations, and I would be willing to accept a motion to that effect.
Is it all three, or you can pick one, two, or three?
I think the intent was all three. If you have a serious concern about one of them, we'd be happy.
It's not and or, it's and.
What's the amount that would be budgeted in item number two?
That's a good question.
We have about $20,000 left in the funds that were allocated to for this project, and like I mentioned, I'm having a meeting tomorrow morning to talk with the consultant about the scope of work. You remember Annalise Burns was here a couple of weeks ago, and she no longer works with the firm. She's moved on to a job with the City of Bellingham, but her partners will be who I'm meeting with tomorrow morning. Makes sense to continue with them because they have knowledge of our project. So I don't know the cost, but I'm looking at it from the perspective of my budget is what's left from what council originally allocated at the maximum, hopefully less than that, because I'd like to save some of that for item three. Basically, I'd like to be able to do two and three within that remaining fund balance of about $19,000 or $20,000.
Any other questions for Raven and Michael?
And if you don't do anything, Harry?
That's always a recommendation.
So there really isn't so much of a do-nothing on this because the city has made some initiatives in the past. Mm-hmm. And those initiatives had to do a lot with building a regional pond. That's what the dam conversation was about. We also have a public works trust loan that's outstanding that we have not acted upon. We do act on it to build that structure. There's really no way for us to pay the money back. So this is a direction that we think is reasonable based upon the economics of the area. I think Raven mentioned in the report that I think there was an expectation that when the recession was over and the ground was available that people would jump all over it. We've had a couple of people interested, but there really hasn't been the outreach that or the response that I think that was anticipated. So we need to redirect it so we can kind of get off the mark with that previous discussion and decision. Is that accurate?
So my option is off the table, yes.
Yep. I move we accept the recommendation.
Okay, motion has been made. Any seconder?
Second it.
Motion has been made and seconded. Are there any further questions or comments? Hearing none, I will call for the vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. Hearing no nays, the motion is carried 5-0. Okay, the next item on our council action items is resolution 1666-15. Supporting the Bay to Bay International Trail.
Mayor and Council, we received the letter that's attached to your agenda bill, and it's really from the Parks and Rec District 2 asking for general support. They're in the process of trying to finish up a part of the trail that they recently received easements for. And it made sense to me to actually bring it to the council as a whole. So thanks to Sherry, we crafted the resolution to kind of serve in the place for what I would consider a council signature when the mayor, if the mayor is authorized to do this. So just to take a little sidebar, it's interesting to me that now that we're coming out of the recession slowly, people are getting more and more interested in projects, the library project, trail projects, facility projects. So this is kind of an exciting time for us. Even the conversation we had just a few minutes ago with the trail up and around Simiamu, and you can look at that as a trail or a path or a sidewalk. A lot of jurisdictions that I've been working with, if they're large enough, the Public Works Department quickly moves those facilities over into the Parks Department. Public Works doesn't want to include them in street maintenance because it, you know, really removes a lot of street capacity. So, you know, thank you for doing that. You know, Raven could have said to Michael, that's really a park structure, and then we would have been really in the creek for that. So this particular item really is a reflection, I think, of more and more things that are going to be happening, including the library conversation and others. So this is a resolution that we crafted to support grant applications that the district's going to be making to the county, to the state, and other federal agencies that provide funding for trail development. We've already done some sections of that trail, the ones on Peace Portal, which terminates right about Hughes. This is the segment up by Lincoln Road. So just ask for approval on this and answer any questions if you might have them.
Any questions for David? No? Okay, staff recommends the City Council adopt resolutions 66-15, supporting Blaine Birch Bay Park and Recreation District Number 2, Bay to Bay International Trail.
So moved.
Motion has been made.
I'll second it.
And seconded. Are there any questions or comments?
I have a question.
Comments?
Okay, so they are going for a grant to get enough money to finish from Lincoln Road to East Drayton Harbor Road, down to where it starts to go around.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're talking about for now.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that one stretch.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're continuing on with the entire project.
Oh, absolutely.
Obviously, the whole idea is to link all the way to White Rock. So absolutely, we want to support this. It's just another piece.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully it'll get around to just Portal Drive eventually.
Yeah, I hope so.
Do they have the easements for that property to at this time?
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons they're going after this so quickly, is they've got the easements, they paid for them, now they want to move, get that trail section developed. So the trail section, as I understand it, you know, there's it'll come down to. I got to talk. Think about this for a moment. It goes. I don't think it goes on Shintafter. I think it goes right through the Blaine Road, and then it comes down the Blaine Birch Bay Road, and then they want to terminate it. They can't make a connection to the berm project. That's the one that's right on the Birch Bay Harbor. Or Birch Bay Beach area. So it starts there, it'll eventually tie to that, it'll go up and around, down through Lincoln area, down into the Drayton Harbor Road. Now the connection of the Drayton Harbor Road is problematic, right? But that is private, those are private properties, and with the right kind of easements and funding, they could carry it all the way then to the bridges. And I think we had a little bit of conversation. My recommendation was for them to not tie themselves into those bridges, do a separate kind of a crossing. I think it would be very difficult to get the county to restructure those roads. But it's a very doable project.
Okay, the motion has been made and seconded. Any further questions or comments? Okay, hearing none, I would call for the vote. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. Hearing none, the motion is carried 5-0. Okay, that brings us to the Commission, Committee, and Board reports. First item is the Blaine Economic Development Advisory Committee. Mr.
Kelberg? We're continuing to work with the Economic Development Committee. I think the last meeting we had a pretty good conversation with the consultant. I want to just take a step back. We had a lot of conversation about having some consulting come in. Council authorized funding up to $65,000, including $20,000 from the Port of Bellingham to do a retail study. While that was going on, we were also having conversations with Peace Help about the possibilities of medical tourism with a medical building. And then we learned that Simiamu Nation acquired 80 more acres on Slater Road, making for 160 acres, and what will probably be some retail. The Peace Health part of it, I think, became clear to me, and I think other council members that were in the committee have similar feelings, which is there's so much uncertainty now about medical from Canada as a medical tourism element of our plan that it made sense to take a step back and kind of reevaluate where we're going. So we did some research and started looking at consultants that could help us kind of focus our energies into a more specific action plan, including a conversation about the Lummi Nation's properties, medical tourism, including all the work that we've already done with the Hebert study, to be much more specific about where we're going. I think the retail element ultimately will be some kind of a boutique process. I can't see, maybe I'm wrong on this, that a big box store is going to come to Blaine. International Mall would have been purchased and renovated. It still sits vacant. So we're looking at all these indicators, and it seems like to me we need to take a step back and be more thoughtful and diligent rather than spending the money for a retail study and then have it and not be able to do really anything with it.
So that's the direction we're going. I'd ask other council members that are on the committee to add to that if you'd like.
Well, my main concern was that we have another study and not take action on it. So the focus this time will be on creating an action plan and doing the action plan.
A more reasonable one?
Stress, yeah, something that is reachable and reasonable. I think we're just going to have to inch towards our goal. I think we can probably get there and not spend a lot of money for this particular type of study. We won't spend any or $65,000.
Yeah. Anyway, the council did authorize us to move forward with the rail study. So this potentially can give us a bit more resource to follow up with that if you'd like.
You're on that committee, aren't you?
Yeah, seems like we're back to what didn't happen, so we have to look at it in the way.
Yeah, we don't want to give up, right? We need to keep working at it.
Yeah, I think it's just trying to figure out what is going to work and then go for it and get started on it. And I think once something happens with any luck, that will generate a little bit more enthusiasm. At the moment, we seem to be in idle, and we need to get in gear and see.
I think it's almost like baby steps.
Yeah.
Where we get something underway. We need something positive to show somebody, even if it's tiny. So that they see
just keep
that
working
something
at it.
Is being generated.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's end my report.
Okay. Steve, we have two reports there, Tourism and Boys and Girls Club.
The Tourism Committee meets tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. For our monthly meeting here. And, of course, the news for the Boys and Girls Club was last week's official groundbreaking for the Pavilion Project, which was very well attended. Great to see the progress and look forward to seeing the finished product.
And just on the tourism, I think the semi-annual open house was very, very well. And if it doesn't draw tourism, I don't know what will. Bonnie, Blaine Chamber of Commerce.
At the meeting last week, Eric Grimstead from the Small Business Development Center presented a program on effective sign design. He had some nice slides with some do's and don'ts on signs. And also Debbie and Alex were there to give limited information, but some information on the city's sign ordinance and answered some questions. There was considerable discussion on the exit into Blaine from the north and how there really needs to be some improvements there and how can we get the state to do something or get the state to allow us to do something or volunteer groups to do something. Also in the roundabout, we wanted to see some effective signage be allowed to put there, and that's something that we have to get state permission for as well. So there was quite a bit of discussion on those two items. But it was some useful information.
Very
well attended to.
Can I ask Michael a question?
Sure, go ahead.
I got to ask about, are they called feather signs?
Mm-hmm.
Feather banners is what they're usually referred to as.
And are those under the code now, or is that something new?
There's a proposal that'll come forward from the Planning Commission for you to, if you approve, it would legalize them. Right now, we're actually going back to Planning Commission. They made a recommendation on some code changes, including signage related to that. And then based on our discussions here and our recent enforcement efforts, we are going back to Planning Commission on Thursday to recommend a couple of other little changes prior to sending it forward to Council, because otherwise what I think we may find ourselves doing is going back through the whole process again to make a couple of other small changes, particularly related to A-frame signs.
Yeah.
Our current code is not very effective for them. It doesn't treat them in a way that makes as much sense as it should. So we're asking the Commission to take a look at that again. Feather banners would become legal if the council were to approve what the Planning Commission is recommending, one per property frontage or more if they have more frontage. They seem to be attractive to business owners. I'm frankly not convinced that they attract business, but that's another issue.
Thank you.
business owners seem to think the more signs you have, the better off you are. But at a certain point, the more signs you have, the more you're just hiding the fact that there even is a business and you're competing. So effectively, people stop listening, stop seeing. But
are they helpful if you have the street trees? Is it going to be more visible?
I don't know.
You can put a sign on the
trees.
You'll get a letter from me if you put a sign on a street tree, and that the notice period on that, because Mr. Mayor, you asked me about that a while back, is the 14-day waiting period before we take the sign down ourselves is Thursday morning at 8 a.m. It ends Wednesday. We can do that because it's also in the public right-of-way and doesn't require any notification. And when I go take it down, I think I'll be accompanied by a police officer.
You can buy the place now.
Dennis, you've got two, the Library Committee and Senior Center Liaison.
They're going to meet the 17th, the library. And I have an idea of what's going to be talked about. Senior Center, they're monitoring the building of the pavilion and the breakfast this weekend, Saturday.
That's good.
Yeah, they got the footings all in and they're ready to pour actually the pad.
That's good. Michael?
No report from the Planning Commission except a reminder that they have a vacancy. So if you know someone who might be worthy. Oh, no, we do have a couple of takers, but it's always good to have more. And I think Sherry will be announcing some interviews shortly. As far as the Park and Cemetery Board goes, they're having a couple of special meetings to put a little bit of extra time into receiving the recommendation from the Open Space Levy Committee. So that will be something coming to you fairly soon, and we anticipate they'll be seeking some input from some other city departments or like Mr. Wilbrecht on what other funding needs does the city have, not that they'll be making those recommendations, but to keep that all in context.
Michael, before you go, and I don't know whether it's you or Sherry. There was a guy out there selling hot dogs on Peace Portal. He just sort of materialized, folded his table out, and started selling hot dogs.
I was on vacation that day, so I disavow any knowledge of the hot
right
dog stand.
Right in front of where the trailer park is.
But my impression was it was in the public right. Oh, impression was it was in the public right of way.
Yeah.
And that would be a police enforcement issue. Did you have something to add, Sherry?
No, I didn't know if that was one of the mobile ones.
He was just a card table guy for the barbecue thing. He looked like he set it up in about 3 seconds.
Is that the guy with the nice stainless?
Yeah.
Barbecue.
Yeah.
He
looked good. I mean, I just want.
Saw you
all
there.
I was asking him is, did he have a permit? He has to have a permit. Doesn't he need to do that?
He has to have a city license to do that.
He has to have that's one. Let me give you a little recap on that. I was on vacation, so I disavow any knowledge of the hot dog stand. But the Raven and I and Chief Haslip recently had a conversation about it. We, from the perspective of mobile food vendors, for Community Development Services, we're taking the approach that if they have a city business license and if they have a health department food handler's permit and they are located on private property in a zone where that kind of activity is permitted, food service, restaurants are generally permitted, then that's a permitted use, unless they're parking in the only available parking spaces. That would be a violation of something else. But then it's a permitted use. When they're in the public right-of-way, that's an entirely different scenario. That would not only need those other things that I mentioned, but I believe it would need a right-of-way permit of some kind. And it may not be even a permit that can be issued, because that's granting favor to someone to use that without a context coming from the city council. And so there's a big difference between a hot dog stand on private property and a hot dog stand in the public right-of-way. So that it just, I don't know what the status of that is. If Chief Haslip were here, he might know, because he might have instructed the gentleman to find somewhere else to sell his hot dogs.
The other thing I have is near steamers, people seem to be able to just pull up and sell their cars or trucks or, I mean, are they licensed to do that? I mean, do you have a license or is it individual sales or how does that work?
It's private property. It's owned by Ron Freeman unless he sold it. And I have no idea if, I don't think Mr. Freeman has a business license to sell cars on his property. I don't think Mr. Freeman is selling cars on his property. I think, like you said, people are just parking their cars on that spot and having a for sale sign in them. We could work on enforcing that parking on his property, but it's, from our perspective, or at least not from my perspective, from a land use point of view, it's not a car lot. It's not a business activity per se when someone's trying to sell their car, just like if they park it in the public right-of-way with a sign for sale on it. But I know what you mean. It just seems to have sort of blossomed all of a sudden.
Yeah, I just was wondering if the statute required you to have so you're opening up a business selling items.
We could basically tell Mr. Freeman that he is not permitted to do that activity on his property, and just like Sam was saying earlier, that's an enforcement action, that is the responsibility of the property owner to not have vehicles parking on his property.
Because there was an antique truck that was there it was old thing, there for a long period of time, and I just wondered if Ron even knew that the guy was...
I have no idea. We haven't taken any action on it, but I'm sure it will be part of our enforcement package when we start doing that.
I was wondering if, that was something we should... I mean, if 10 cars get on there, I think we probably want to...
Then it's a car lot, I think, a used car lot.
Because the fireworks guys park there as well, and I assume that...
They get a license for that.
They're licensed to do that. So if they're licensed to do that, I assume that somebody would be licensed to sell it. If they were selling more than one automobile, they obviously would be going into business.
Good problem.
Well, we're kind of on the topic of food carts.
Oh.
What if someone had a hot dog cart, let's say, and they just wanted to, on a Saturday, put it in the G Street Plaza or H Street or whatever? Can they get a permission? And assuming they have a business license and the health department permit.
Because we thought that was such an outstanding idea, it is included in the downtown code rewriting related to design standards and some other use changes that got stalled due to our litigation issue with a consultant that wanted to sue us if we used the work. And so I've been trying to figure out a way to bring those components forward to you, which are use of the public right-of-way for things like the Oyster Company wanted to do, like we wrote that into the code, that idea, and then he said, hey, could I do this? And it was like, yeah, we're trying to make it legal. Yeah. And the hot dog cart would be the same kind of thing. So we're trying to figure out how to bring that forward. It's out of context when we don't bring the whole package, but it's happening, and we want to embrace it.
An encroachment permit just to be able to do it. And who knows when we're going to get this thing all approved.
Right.
It might be months. I mean, summer will be over.
Yeah, we do have other mechanisms.
They could get an encroachment permit like they would if they're on a sidewalk or something.
Potentially. I would much rather have it with council have a law that says this is permissible and staff can approve it.
But I just don't want to waste the whole summer. We can have some things like that going.
In the farmer's market, somebody could open up a stand there, could they?
The farmer's for the gardener's market? Well, the gardener's market has permission to be there, so people... who operate, they operate under their umbrella.
But they require a business license and a health thing to sell hot dogs?
If it's part of the market because it falls under something permitted by the city, such as the 4th of July when we have the vendors, we don't require them to get a business license. They're falling under the umbrella, as Michael said, in this case of the chamber.
Right, our code has a special provision
so
for like a
Portal
vendor.
Needs to move his operation to the
right. You see, that's the thing. He's not selling local product that he's created in his home or on his own property or whatever their requirements are. He's not gardening. He's buying Frank's from Costco.
So he
and selling
can't do it, is what you're saying.
I don't think the farmer's market.
Could he do it if he got a license and a health permit?
Totally separate from the gardener's market, he might be able to, as Ms. Onion is mentioning, that's a different context.
Okay. Or even if they approve it as an exception or something to allow food.
Because I think that would be, to me, if the farmer's market would benefit from having somebody selling hot dogs.
But so far they haven't been, that would have to be approached to them.
To them, yeah.
It seems like a lot of work.
Okay. Thank you.
One more thing, I just wanted to make a little announcement. Last Saturday morning, down at Marine Park, we had a productive work session. Alex donated most of his day for that on Saturday, and there'll be another one starting this coming Saturday at 9 a.m. We hope by the end of that session to have all of the excavation work prepared and ready for the contractor to come in and start being able to put in some of the cement work. So hopefully, if anybody has any time, stop down, if not to help give encouragement.
I appreciate that. I got up here basically mostly to say that and thank the volunteers who were involved. Alex was one, Mr. Lawrenson was another, and there were many, many other people out there handling excavation, hauling away the material to prep the site for the playground, which they hope to have done, as Mr. Lawrenson said, after one more work day.
When's the next work day?
It's going to be Saturday.
You can come and eat breakfast and go to work.
Yeah.
There you go.
And go visit the library with it.
For the senior
for free
if I bring your
group
would be.
Oh,
awesome.
Yeah. No problem.
Raven, how about the Public Works Advisory Committee?
Our committee did meet on June 1st and primarily was a follow-up on the TIP and introduction to our electric system. Our next meeting, our consultant for the electric comp plan will be coming and essentially asking some feedback from the committee regarding different types of electrical stuff. So it should be interesting.
I don't think we have any for the Small Cities Caucus, the Finance Committee, or the Whatcom Council of Government, any reports. But we do have the North Whatcom Fire update, Chief Hollander. And I hope he's brought his recipe with him.
I'm sad to say I have a recipe, but no samples. I'm disappointed in that.
We're disappointed.
However, I do have some sad news I need to share with you. We did have in the city today at the Golden Nut factory had an industrial accident that resulted in a fatality with a collapse of a steel structure behind the building. It was not any of the employees of the Golden Nut factory. It was a sub. We're not totally sure yet, but they were removing the steel structure, I think, for scrap is what I'm being told. I don't have a lot of those details yet. The PD would. But I thought you should be notified anyway that there was an industrial fatality accident and just after lunch today. So if anybody calls.
Is it a Blaine resident?
Excuse me?
Is it a Blaine resident? Or?
I don't believe it was a Blaine resident, but a lot of family, and they were all there. They came right to the scene, obviously, so there was a lot to deal with. And PD did a great job today, and support was there. We did the best we could for the family. I don't know if they are citizens of Blaine or not. I don't think so.
Was the pastoral support person there?
Yeah. Charles was there and Kendra both were there. Yeah.
Golden Nut.
From the Peanut Factory, just across the street from the fire station.
Well, let's hope the samples are being worked on for
next time.
2 weeks from now. Department reports, Public Works, project updates.
All right. Well, been up here enough tonight. I'll just try to swim through these, but just give you a couple project updates. The monitoring well that you awarded last month is starting up this week. The pipeline electrical, which is the kind of the subsequent follow-up project to the pipeline work we did back in 13, where we put water main in. We also ran electrical conduits. So we actually have a bid out now on our roster, so it's not on the website, to pull the electrical wires and do the configuration so that we can underground the electrical system all the way out to our watershed. Ooh, really excited about that. A meeting with WSDOT this Thursday on a possible alternative to the I-274 project. essentially asking them to consider it in phases and really focus on the northbound off as the highest priority. And we've been working with the property owner with the possibility of having the interchange land on Hughes. The reason for that is we have money now, you know, lined up for improving Hughes to all weather, to realigning the Hughes intersection. And by doing this, again, it's an interim project, doesn't necessarily substitute for other projects, but it could also take some of the impact from the Bell Peace Portal intersection if we're giving people another way off. And
so there'd be two ways off.
Right now there is no way off southbound. I'm talking about southbound off ramp.
She
said
north.
Did I say north? I'm so sorry. No. I'm sorry. No. It's the heat. Southbound off ramp onto Hughes.
Raven, has the state transportation bill been passed? Or?
No.
It's still in the works, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is there any word?
It's crazy. They have passed an operations budget so that all the different transportation agencies stay solvent, but they haven't passed any project. Yeah, it's very frustrating.
Yes. Because 274 would probably be in there somewhere.
The last I heard, it was still surviving. It's on one of the top projects on the COG list, but you have to remember that we've got lobbyists for Bellingham and Whatcom County that are pushing Slater and Bakerview for Costco. So we do have a lot of competition locally as well as statewide, yeah. Unfortunately.
They've not passed a transportation bill in, what, 6 years or something?
Yeah.
They're pretty desperate to get that done.
In your previous update, you talked about can the state do something at Bell Road? I just wanted to remind you, we do have a project at Peace Portal and Bell. It's not the ultimate fix, which would probably be putting a bridge over the railroad tracks, but essentially extending some of the turn lanes so that there's more holding space for people that are stuck for the train. And we are currently reviewing that design with the state and plans to build it with local funds. I've been getting absolutely no interest from them whatsoever in helping us to fund the project. Yes. His question was kind of overlapped enforcement and project, you know, and so that's why I've been trying to touch base with the chief, and that just hasn't happened. But we will definitely get back to him, and absolutely that will be part of the response. In fact, I think he knows that.
We should put a circle there so people around and around and around.
Oh, it's actually funny. Someone brought that up. And it didn't take too long to snuff it out, though, because you get one person who's waiting for a train to clog up that roundabout, then you really...
I could just go around and around.
Keep going around. There you go. I think that was my response, Mr. Mayor, but anyway.
It hasn't come up.
I appreciate you all who have noticed the amazing improvements to the beach at Marine Park. And the work that Kim Freeman did to maybe pass him a message of good luck. He's actually leaving employment with us as of tomorrow. And we're going to miss him greatly. He's been a huge asset to the department. Unfortunately, he's in high value, and he found a better offer. And so that, like I said, if you would be so inclined to pass something on, he'll be in all day tomorrow. Our reclaimed water season has begun, so we are shipping water up to the golf course, and my understanding is they're taking every single bit we can send them, and the weather's been so dry. So it's great news for the sewer fund and great news for the golf course. Of course, with Memorial Day passed, flags and flowers are up on all the light posts downtown. We have a cleanup day, a community cleanup day scheduled for the 19th of June. This is to prepare for the July 4th, and we would certainly invite you or any of your constituents that might be interested.
Are we going to put the
I believe so. That's probably a notice that we need to make sure that we get out when we do notice it.
I'll talk to Debbie because usually for the I think it's Make Blaine Sparkle or something like that is the theme. I work with Debbie on that.
I did want to let you know on the sad side, this is the memorial that is out on Marine Drive right now, past the plant where the fellow drove off, pushed the ecology block off. You know, while we want to be sensitive to those that are grieving, it's been a couple weeks, and it is our intention to clean this up. There's portions of motorcycle parts. There's a little letter there with some inappropriate language. It's not the image that we want to have in our right of way. So I just want to let you know in case you get any calls about that.
Last year I was approached by a gentleman saying, do we have a hard and fast rule as to what you can leave there? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know there's crosses around. Mm-hmm. Do we have a hard and fast rule that says you can do this for a limited period of time, or do we have...
I'd have to research, but I don't believe there's any kind of policy or municipal code on that particular subject.
Yeah, he was suggesting that perhaps maybe we need to define what is permitted or not permitted. Okay. Probably not a bad idea.
Okay. Well, I made note of that. You already mentioned the groundbreaking. I just had to show this great picture of our wonderful city manager out there.
Well, we're not
operating that thing. Yep, doing the hard work there. You know.
I noticed Mel's shovel had more dirt in it than yours.
And then finally, our wastewater funding coalition has stopped work for this season in light of the legislative session. They're kind of seeing the handwriting on the wall. We remain a member of that coalition, and I plan on meeting with them when I'm at the AWC conference at the end of this month. They're going to be having a meeting, and we can talk about ways that we might be able to get back into things once this session is closed and see what other ideas we can come up with. So that's my report.
Okay. You'd be pleased to know that the fourth graders are
Thank you. I forgot to mention that. We had our poster contest last week.
Wonderful. We're really excited about it.
Well, thank you for participating in that, Mr. Mayor.
My pleasure to be there. I learned a lot. They really are. Came into the room and she was devastated. Everybody in the audience.
Give a report, Michael.
I just report that it's too hot.
So I'll follow that up and say
we
have a closed session, executive session. Wrong. Shouldn't take very long.
Okay. Okay, we've got community development services.
No report, sir.
Okay, city manager.
Just that we're going to have an executive session.
Okay. Any unfinished business from the council? Any council new business? Okay, hearing none. At 8:09, we're going to break for executive session. How long do you anticipate this to take?
15 minutes and no action.
15 minutes and no action is anticipated.
Yeah. I need to take a quick run downstairs.